Chapter 1. Friday, February 21st, 2020. Mars. The small point of light moved toward them, an unhurried but relentless advance across a lifeless red plain. Not an out-of-the-ordinary sight on Earth, perhaps, a slow vehicle crossing the high desert. But this was Mars. And until moments ago, 8 Martian astronauts, along with all of mankind, had thought those 8 astronauts were the sole living beings on this forsaken, desiccated planet. The glint still headed straight for us. Rear Admiral John Wells, known to his crew as Hawk, pointed at the computer display, consternation knitting his brow. At the current speed of advance, it'll be here in 3 days, tops. John heard the quickened breathing of the 7 other astronauts gathered around him in the quiet of the Martian morning. Hemmed inside their tight cylindrical home, the crew formed a tense circle in the Mission Operations Center of their laboratory module.
"You've only seen those reflections at sunrise, right?"
Martin Oswald, their lanky flight engineer, better known as Oz, winced as he plucked hair from the side of his head. The guy's nerves had gotten so bad, the bald spot was hard to miss now. Colonel Melanie Knox nodded and looked up from a data terminal, her small frame bristling with energy.
"Satellite surveillance picks up a glint as it crosses the horizon every morning, but only at low sun angles. There's no mistake. Something's out there. I woke you because I wanted you all to see for yourselves."
She studied her wide-eyed crewmates and waved a hand across the screen.
"Whatever it is, guys, it's closing on us."
John's crew conferred an hour later in the dining area of the habitation module. Everyone but John nursed a mug of coffee as they debated the next step.
"Houston's probably flipping out right now, and no one knows what we're dealing with."
Dr. Deborah Reedy sighed and pushed a frazzled jumble of wiry strawberry hair over her shoulder.
"It looks like a vehicle in this image, but it's too blurry to be sure."
Deborah tossed a glossy printout onto the scuffed plastic of their 8-person dinner table. All eyes riveted on the photo's fuzzy detail of what looked like a silver box. Behind her, a large wall monitor displayed expanded video images of the silver thing overlaid on a map of the deeply eroded Nurgle Valles region of Mars. This was their home, a rugged land of ravines and gullies, hundreds of miniature Grand Canyons coursing across the pockmarked face of bone-dry, dusty Mars. A lonely planet, distant from all John had ever known and loved, and proving more barren by the day. Until now.
"That thing's blurry because we're taking the pictures with a weather bird, Deborah," Oz said as he peered at the photo. "The satellite's 21,000 kilometers above the planet. It's not designed for high-resolution imagery."
He slumped in his seat, bony shoulders spiking up under a loose blue NASA jumpsuit.
"Shoot, I'm surprised Melanie saw that reflection at all." "We're alone, right, John? No secret manned missions?"
He tossed a crumpled juice packet at their commander.
"And no aliens?"
John caught the trash ball one-handed and shook his head. "You know as much about this as I do, Oz." He stared at the glossy photo. "Deborah's right. NASA freaked when I told him."
"Is it any wonder?" Melanie said. "We've got no idea what we're dealing with."
"There won't be any better imagery to help us. Mars Surveyor won't be in orbit till we're long gone."
Jake Cook spoke for the first time that morning. The big man's deep voice reverberated like a bass drum in the gleaming white habitation module.
"So, what do we know? Something big, of unknown origin, is headed our way."
Jake pulled the glossy image toward him, then leaned over the table, resting his large frame on his elbows.
"We have 2 choices. Either we intercept this thing and deal with it, or we sit on our hands and wait for it to arrive. In either event, we have to make some quick decisions when we meet it. Them. Whatever.
Jake sat up, leaned back in his chair, and waved a hand at the airlock.
Remember, we aren't armed, and our only transportation off this planet is unguarded, a kilometer away.
His comment touched a nerve. No one ever considered guarding anything on Mars. They all started to talk at once.
Jake's got a point.
Melanie stood up to focus the group's attention. They quieted as she pointed a cursor at the track prediction on the screen.
We can't even lock the doors. I'd rather act than wait.
She turned toward John, her gentle brown eyes demanding a response. The crew geologist, Dr. Robert Witt, spoke with an aggravating nasal tone.
You're delusional, all of you. We know we're alone, right? It's probably a glint in the camera lens at sunrise.
He huffed.
Just a blip. Nothing to get excited about.
John raised a hand for silence as the others railed at Geo, their crew skeptic. He surveyed the four men and three women waiting for his pronouncement. Navy Rear Admiral John Wells, commander of the third manned mission to Mars, Hawk, America's most experienced astronaut. That's what the news ticker said once when he was on camera. It was time to command.
Put a lid on it, folks. Geo's point's as valid as any other right now.
John turned toward the blurry silver image on the big screen. Resting both elbows on the table, his chin perched on his folded hands, the crew waited for him to speak. It was a tense silence. Maybe it is a figment of our imagination, he thought. A noisy ventilation fan rattled in the background, distracting him. After 500 dry, dusty days on the planet, things broke down much too often. Can't afford major failures now. 4 more months to go. When they'd begun this odyssey nearly 17 months ago, everyone dreamed of water and ice on Mars, assuming they were alone on a planet shaped eons ago by rivers and lakes. They came looking for microscopic life, fully expecting to find it. The equipment functioned perfectly, and failures were minimal. Lately, however, John spent half his time fixing broken stuff. The planet was bone dry and devoid of life everywhere they'd drilled, and now a vehicle appeared to be headed across this dusty rock toward them. Somehow, he sensed, their mission was about to be tested unlike any other before them on Mars.
I agree with Mel, John said at last. If something's out there, we can't let it get to us first. I'll coordinate the details with Houston and we'll head out today to investigate. Blue team suit up. Gold team stays here.
He looked at Melanie, his second in command.
Be prepared to get your team out of here fast, Mel. You might not get much notice.
John moved slowly down the 6 steps from the airlock, thinking about the next 10 hours. His foot settled into the sugar-like dust of Mars, a familiar squishy sensation that affirmed he was outside. His hard, bulky suit fit like a well-worn glove, and he took a deep breath of the dry, recycled air, glad to be outdoors, despite the circumstances. It felt good to be afoot again, for the first time in a week. The inside of his Mars suit smelled like a locker room after a year and a half of hard use, but the rigid torso fit like he was born into it. And, in a manner of speaking, he was born for this. Space exploration, his lifelong passion. He looked into the distant amber sky above a rust-red rocky plain pocked with craters and ridges. A deep gorge ran west. He never wanted to forget this experience, standing on the face of another planet nearly 200 million kilometers from Earth. 7 years ago, John had floated in his suit attached to his crippled ship Epsilon, staring into the void of space as he passed Venus. Alone. A terrifying isolation. Yet the chill of the loneliness back then couldn't compare to the apprehension that gripped him now. He prayed for calm, but an inner voice, the quiet whisper of God's guidance, urged him on. Go! A salmon-colored disk, surrounded by a halo of fine dust particles, shone in the morning sky. John stared beyond the team of four astronauts, his eyes on a distant, rugged, and increasingly ominous horizon.
You ready, old man?
Jake let out a belly laugh as John gazed into the sun.
If you're not up to this, we can grab you a wheelchair.
John smiled, knowing his old friend couldn't see his grin. The sun's reflection glinting off the gold-tinted visor of his helmet was too bright.
I'm older, Mr. Cook, but definitely wiser. Be glad the shrinks gave me a thumbs up to keep an eye on you pups. You'd never have made it this far without me. You're probably right, Methuselah.
Jake patted John's backpack.
Methuselah? Yeah, like that old geezer in the Bible. You're the oldest man on Mars.
Methuselah, Noah's grandfather. A sudden rush of memories ripped at John's heart, and he saw Amy, a petite brunette with a Bible picture book, reading about the ark with his young sons on a late summer morning while they all watched a torrential rainstorm. Baby Alice rolled on the floor in a layette, and the aroma of Saturday's breakfast of bacon and biscuits lingered in the air. That recollection of family warmth turned to ice in an instant, replaced by memories of their funeral. His wife and four children ripped from him 6 years ago next month, body parts raining down in a hail of burning aircraft wreckage. John grunted as if he'd been kicked in the gut. Gritting his teeth, he shoved the pain of this daily mental hell deep inside. His raw grief compartmentalized yet again, the old pilot joined his team.
You okay, pal?
Jake studied John from his position beside the rest of the crew.
Yeah, fine. I'm ready.
John stepped forward, a checklist in his gloved hand. His family's loss was like acid rising in his throat. Forcing it back down didn't soothe the burn.
We've got a unique mission today, ladies and gentlemen.
Three suited astronauts stood before him next to a large rover that reminded John of a California strawberry packer. Six huge wheels suspending a glass-walled cab 2 meters above the ground. John read from the miniature video screen on his data tablet.
80 kilometers round trip. Our primary target is probably some kind of vehicle, based on the image. Should take us 10 hours, give or take an hour. That plus, he paused, whatever we'll need to respond to the approaching visitor.
Visitor? Oz exclaimed. Thought you said we're alone, Hawk.
John shrugged.
Call it a target, then.
Yeah, target. I like that.
Oz sounded both pleased and anxious.
Are we armed?
You know we aren't, so give it a rest, Oz.
Jake was tense, too.
We need to get going. Oxygen supplies and fuel checked out fine, John. Melanie did the rover pre-flight for us.
Melanie nudged John in the side.
I'd be glad to lead the team and let you stay here.
John smiled. Thanks, Mel. But I need you to stay and hold down the fort. If John gave her the word, Melanie would leave without them, taking half of the Mars crew aloft to their return vessel in orbit. To safety.
You got the keys?
Melanie nodded at his playful question, then laid a gloved hand on his arm, the top of her helmet barely as high as his shoulder. She held on for a long moment, her shiny visor hiding a normally expressive face.
Be careful, John. I want us to leave this rock as a team.
12 o'clock,
Jake exclaimed loudly as they crested a low berm 4 hours later. He leaned between Deborah and John, pointing toward a bright object that lay directly in front of the rover. John's heart skipped a beat. It can't be. Startled, Deborah braked hard, pitching John forward. Jake grabbed at the seats to keep from spilling over the control console. Oz held onto the back of John's seat, craning his long neck to see the brilliant point of light 50 meters beyond them.
Closer?
Deborah asked as Jake urged her to continue. John nodded, unable to form a word. Vertigo gripped him. His head spun. A tsunami of nausea rolled through John's gut. Everything he'd held sacred, including proof of the alien fakeries he thought he'd exposed long ago, all exploded before the glowing object just over the ridge's crest. A familiar golden sphere lay in the dust, shimmering with an intense luster. There could be no doubt now.
We're not alone.
Jake and Oz stood with John outside the rover, near an orb the size of a large orange, shimmering gold. The glow intensified as John approached it. No one spoke. Even talkative Deborah was silent, sitting at the controls of the rover behind them.
Impossible.
There's no dust on it, Hawk.
Oz photographed the scene, kneeling to get within a couple of meters from the globe.
No tracks that I can see.
Maybe it landed here, John thought. Of all places on Mars, for whatever reason, the globe lay directly in his path. John's heart beat so hard he was sure Jake, Oz, and Deborah could hear it pounding. He fought to breathe deep, to calm down, but failed. He'd convinced himself years ago that these orbs were part of a complex tapestry of deception, instruments of someone or some nation capitalizing on a perpetual spiritual hunger in generations of questioning people, self-deluded people scattered across the earth who wanted to believe in an alien race. He forced a shallow breath and shuddered.
Was I wrong?
Looks just like those orbs you guys tried to bring back from Mars on your first mission, John.
Jake stood across from him. John kneeled, his hand reaching toward but not touching the glowing sphere. It was like the others, a perfect duplicate of the gifts that purported aliens had left 7 years ago on Earth to announce a mysterious coming father race, a race that supposedly had seeded human life long ago throughout the galaxy, and on Earth.
They were a ruse, weren't they? The aliens and that weird religion burgeoning on Earth?
He'd been convinced then. But here was more proof, on Mars. John leaned toward the beautiful sphere. His gloved hand hovered above the mystical ball, his heart racing.
Don't touch it, Hawk!
He heard Deborah's voice, but her message didn't register.
I have to know.
No, Hawk!
Someone yelled on his comlink as he reached closer to the radiant sphere.
We don't know if it's safe.
It never harmed the others.
John's glove shook as he lowered it, oblivious to Deborah's screams and the slam of frantic heartbeats in his ears. Oz put a gloved hand on his shoulder to restrain him, but John shook it off.
This is my chance.
John's rubber-tipped fingers touched the orb, and it exploded with a piercing blue radiance.
Don't touch it,
Amy cried as little Abe crawled toward their meager Christmas tree. Before she could reach him, their crawling baby had grabbed a low branch and the holiday decorations were crashing down upon him. Springing from the rug in the center of their den, John barely missed getting a hand under the toppling fir and the star atop it. Like diving for a football in the end zone, he'd only managed to get a hand on one ornament, a precious blue glass ball he'd bought for his mother years earlier, and that she had recently donated to their collection. The remainder of Amy's ancient hand-blown ornaments splintered on the floor around their babe.
John!
Deborah's piercing scream brought him back to Mars. Knee-deep in red dust, he grasped the blue globe between white-gloved hands. An adrenaline-driven blue jolt shot through John's eyes and down his neck, exploding shivers through his shoulder and spine. Goose flesh rose on his arms and legs as his muscles tensed for fight or flight. He was now the sixth. The first blue explosions had occurred when two silver spider craft presented their orbs to Mars rover 8 years ago, 1,000 kilometers north-northwest of where he was now. Bob Kanuski said it happened the same way when her late brother accepted the third orb from Earth's first spider visitors only 12 days later in a swamp at Cape Canaveral. On Mars 7 years ago, his late friend and Martian explorer, Dr. Michelle Caskey, had experienced the blue explosion of light as she accepted the fourth orb from alien spiders. Aliens who met her landing craft on the day she was the first human to touch the red planet. A month later, a fifth orb blazed in the hands of Father Malcolm Raines, greeting a group of silver spiders in the cloister of a Benedictine abbey on France's Mont Saint-Michel. 5 brilliant golden orbs, each presented by tall, silver, spider-like visitors, followed by 5 blinding blue flashes when the orbs were first touched. The blaze of this sixth orb was too brilliant to watch, and John turned his head as he grasped the sphere tightly with both hands. In a moment, the blue outburst faded to an azure glow.
Why here? Why now?
The inside of his clammy Mars suit suddenly felt icy cold. John stood still, clutching the blue globe. He fully expected a towering silver spider to materialize out of thin air and spear him through the chest with its sharp-tipped leg. The alien robot landers, 3 meters tall, should be flying in for an 8-legged landing or walking up single file, a deep bass voice booming at him from nowhere. That's the way it usually happened. Or maybe he should expect the tall space preacher, Father Malcolm Raines, to saunter up in flowing purple robes as he had on Mont Saint-Michel, hands raised to the sky, exclaiming, "Father, our number is 6. The events of the past 8 years on Earth and Mars had seen every fashion of strange occurrence with the presentation of these mysterious orbs. He had no idea what to expect next, and no idea why he'd found one here, in the middle of nowhere, on Mars. Something would happen soon. It always did. Moments later, John stood in response to a tug on his arm, probably Oz trying to get his attention.
"Over there!" Jake yelled on the comlink.
"I see him, but..." Deborah gasped. "John?"
Oz's voice was strangely low and subdued. John turned toward Oz and held up the ball. "Number 6?"
"No."
His friend's voice was stern.
"Turn around, Hawk. Now."
John shuffled around, then flinched. The orb slipped from his grasp and fell into the dust at his feet. For a moment he was back in Clear Lake City in late October, cleaning windows for Amy. His oldest son, Abe, had crept through the living room in a ghoulish Halloween mask, then pressed his face against the glass. When John turned back to his task with a fresh paper towel, he'd met the bloody face with a scream, like the scream he'd just stifled. A short humanoid stood 100 meters away. It was dressed in what appeared to be a brilliant silver suit, like none John had ever seen before, topped with a strange trapezoidal helmet sporting 2 vertical antennae. The humanoid raised what looked like a hand, perhaps in greeting.
"Heart rate 145. John, breathe!"
Deborah's words pricked him, and he gasped for the breaths he'd missed. He couldn't make himself move. 50 years of alien images from picture books, movies, and pure wonder, dreaming since childhood that he might, of all humans, be the first to meet another life form, played at once like a mental movie in this historic encounter.
"It's true. We're not alone."
In a flash, the movie strip broke, his mental film reel spinning out of control as the implication slapped him repeatedly.
"I was wrong. There is life. Intelligent alien life.
The silver-clad humanoid kept its hand high, palm facing him. John's radio crackled, but it wasn't the usual clear radio link from his crew. This voice was like none he'd ever heard. It was high-pitched, almost girlish.
"We've been searching for you, my mother and I.